This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
And welcome to the Music to My Ears podcast, brought to you by BBC Music Magazine, the world's best-selling classical music monthly. I'm Freya Parr, the magazine's digital editor and staff writer, and this week I'm speaking to the Polish countertenor Jakub Józef Olinski. We chatted about his entry into music and how he'd initially aimed to join the Kingsingers, but a love of Baroque music soon took over. He also told me about his love of breakdancing, why he believes shorter concerts are the future, and why ambient music provides the backdrop to his travels. As someone known for his many world premiere recordings, Jakub explained the complicated process of working with what he calls a treasure hunter to find these unknown pieces, and how he goes about performing and recording them for the very first time.
How has travel been for the last year of lockdown then? Has it affected your life as a performer?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, there are hundreds of concerts that were cancelled, and actually the pleasure of traveling is... It disappeared, you know? It's so difficult. It's so difficult to get to another country because the restrictions are changing every single day, basically. So I already had situations when I was not let on board because they just changed like 5 hours before my flight. They changed the regulations and I had to have another sort of quick test like within those past 4 hours. So I couldn't fly even like transit through Amsterdam. So I was just like, I had to rebook my flight. And instead of 6 hours of traveling, I had like 18 or something like that. Yeah. It's really a big mess. And it's not fun anymore. I have to be honest, it's not fun. It's super cool to finally get somewhere because in January, we had a little tour. It's supposed to be a big tour, but unfortunately only Spain decided to kind of go on and put those concerts on. So we had 4 concerts in Spain and it was amazing. People really were crazy, like really crazy about the music. And I don't think it was necessarily because of our interpretations, but in general that something is happening. And they were so hungry for like live performance that really... Even though there were restrictions of, you know, like you can have only 1 hour and like 10 minutes of music because there cannot be a break, we would play 3 or 4 encores. So it was like an hour and a half or even longer because they would just not let us out.
Wow. So that's like quite a difference in terms of what you're usually used to. The concert format in itself has changed.
Yeah, of course. I mean, now in general, the regulations is that like you cannot have a break in the program. So it has to be just like one sort of set, and it changes quite a lot, because usually when I program something, I have an idea of like, okay, so in the first part, I usually have one instrumental piece in like sort of in between my arias, and then in the second part also. But this time it's really kind of long, boom, boom. And you have to just maintain 1 hour on stage, or 1 hour and 10 minutes usually. And that's it.
Do you have to change the way you prepare for that then? Or is that a different mindset to get into?
Not to brag, but I have a quite big stamina for performing, and I don't really need a break. It's the break is usually for people to enjoy and like, you know, talk a little bit and have a drink. But in those conditions right now, everything is closed. So even in Spain, the concert halls are open, but nothing else is open. So like you cannot just hang out in the lobby or foyer to just chill and talk with people, because then it's risky. So they don't allow it. So I think I don't really struggle with the format. I actually kind of like it. Because in general, I think sometimes concerts should be shorter, and then you can add some anchors, of course, if people are hungry, but it's better to always leave people hungry instead of giving them so much that they are like, oh my gosh, this is getting a little bit tiring.
There's no room for the post-concert chat.
Yeah, this is something that I really struggle with, because I really like to meet the audience, like the people who are like listening to the concert, and usually they're really writing me before on social media or via email that they would love to have a signature or something, or just talk or have a selfie or something. And I like to do that. I treat it as part of the concert. Like it's sort of the thing. Like I sing a concert and then I do that. And sometimes like in Paris, it takes like an hour and a half, because the line is so long and so many people are like super excited and they want to meet the artist, and it's nice. I have to say that it is a nice feeling to talk with those people. And sometimes you meet really crazy, interesting people, sometimes crazy other people, but yeah. But it's really, really fun, and I like to do that. And now it cannot happen because of the restrictions, unfortunately.
Yeah, of course. When life returns to normal, when you're traveling around, what do you tend to listen to on in transit?
Ooh, I have actually my set. Because it's really important for me as a traveling artist, as a freelancer, because I travel a lot. Like for the past 8 years before the pandemic started, I really traveled a lot, and sometimes it's 1 hour, you know, travel, sometimes it's 8 hours, 9 hours on the flight. So I have a friend, Hania Rani, and I love to listen to her music. It's like this ambient style piano music, and it's super, super good. And it's sometimes when I need to like fall asleep and just chill, I put the whole album and I listen to it. But sometimes also this type of music inspires me, and I always have my notebook, so I write ideas. I just write a lot of ideas, a lot of things that I have to do, I have to manage, I have to like kind of deal with, but also a lot of ideas for new projects, for new collaborations, for things. So this type of music, this ambient music, especially by Hania Rani, is crucial during traveling. And also I have one album by Arte dei Suonatori. It's a Polish ensemble. A really, really great ensemble. And they recorded an album years ago. I think it's from like 2010 or something like that, with Telemann Flute Concertos. And it's so beautiful. I don't know. I'm just like, I don't know. It's just so beautiful. And it's engaging in a way that like sometimes I can really listen and be engaged in the music and analyze and kind of, you know, put myself in. But sometimes it's just such a nice background for my thoughts to just like kind of run around and just have a breath and chill. In general, Baroque instrumental music is my to-go-to thing.
So you don't tend to listen to choral stuff necessarily that you would perform?
No, absolutely not. I think it just comes from the fact that I love, for example, Renaissance music, because I come from the choir background, and I really love listening to Renaissance music by Thomas Tallis or Thomas Luis da Victoria, Palestrina, all of those really, you know, great masters. But this music is very complicated, complex polyphony, and it's very engaging. Like my brain, and also because I did it for so many years. I was 12 years in the choir, so it really engages in me in a way that, like, I have to be involved. I have to actively listen. So it's not a good thing for me to listen while I'm traveling or to have some other ideas and think about other stuff. It's just clearly I like to listen to it and enjoy it. But baroque instrumental music is something that I really tend to listen in those moments. And vocal, I'm a singer. I mean, like, I constantly sing, so like when I can listen to something without singing, I would rather do that.
Yeah, escapism. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So you mentioned that you were in a choir there for a number of years. Tell me about your upbringing. Did you grow up in like a musical household?
Not really. Actually, not really. My mom played guitar, but just more of a hobby thing. And my whole family, they're like visual artists. So my grandma from my mother's side, she was an architect. From my father's side, my grandpa is an architect. My grandma from my father's side is sculpturing teeth. I don't know how you call it like in English. Sorry. Yeah, but she makes fake teeth, and it's wow. Also like visual art, you know. Yeah. You have to like sculpture in it. And she's still doing it. So it's pretty crazy. And my mom is a painter and a sculptor. My father also is a graphic designer and painter. So they're like really artists. So always there was this sort of understandment of importance of culture and visual art and music. So of course they were listening to some good music, I would say. It was kind of a coincidence that I got into that choir, because it's amateur choir. There was a lady going from school to school, from primary school to primary school, auditioning boys, because it's boys and men choir. And I got in when I was 8 years old, sort of like that. So, and then I stayed for 12 years, right? Yeah.
So what were your parents playing at home then? If you mentioned they had good music, what was the good music?
I mean, good music in a meaning, like there was no, what we call in Poland, disco polo.
Right.
So it's this like very cheap and very bad lyrics music. Usually it was like some sort of, let's say, famous Polish songwriters, songs, some like, I wouldn't say even pop music. It was more like... I don't know. It's like sort of like a French chanson. We have this Polish style of like sung poetry, for example, but it's super, super nice. And especially in like from the generation of my parents, there was a lot of that. And the lyrics are super beautiful. So when we were traveling to Polish seaside or going to the mountains, we were listening to a lot of those kind of this kind of music. So I think my musical taste also comes from that. Maybe not that much classical music, although my mom loves to listen to classical music while she paints. So that was also in my ear from time to time.
Yeah. Are there any of those albums that you listen to of kind of Polish music that you still return to now? Are there any that stand out in your memory?
Yes, there is Grechuta, a very famous sort of Polish guy, and his songs are beautiful. So from time to time I really like to listen to them, and especially when I go to practice, for example, a new program with my pianist Michał Biel, I go to his countryside. He lives in a small village close to Częstochowa. Częstochowa is like a little bit bigger city. And we sit, we practice, we sing for hours, we, you know, discuss things. But then also in the evenings, we like to chill, drink something and listen to things like that.
Yeah. You mentioned you were singing in the choir. At what point did you take that to another level and develop your voice as a solo singer as well?
So the thing is that I was obsessed with the King Singers. Like when I was singing in the choir, I went as a teenager already for the concert in Warsaw Philharmonics. And they had a concert and I was like in the third row, very close. And I saw this group and I was like blown away. Like the mastery, the professionalism and the comedy aspect just got me. And from that point, I feel like I just got this sort of impression that like, this is what I want to do. This is what I want. I want to be a very highly professional, you know, skilled singer, let's say, but also put some sort of humor in it, but it has to be good level, to be good level. So that was the point. Like I was singing in that choir and because in my high school, I still didn't know what I want to do with my life. I kept singing in that choir and decided that I'm going to try to audition for the university in Warsaw for solo singing just to kind of, you know, polish my my technique, vocal technique, to be better in the ensemble and then maybe one day audition to an ensemble like the King Singers. But then my world kind of got twisted a little bit because I really fell in love with Baroque music and especially Baroque music, because not only I do sing other things, but that was like the major thing that I did. And then it a little bit changed, but I still do like to sing in an ensemble, and I did a little collaboration with the King Singers during the pandemic, so it was super exciting. And I miss it. Sometimes I really, really miss it.
Do you remember what the first piece of music that you fell in love with was? Was it a Baroque piece?
I don't know exactly, but there is one memory that I have that when we were preparing as teenagers, sort of this one piece by Thomas Luis da Victoria, O Magnum Mysterium. Mm-hmm. And it's such a beautiful piece that I remember that like when our conductor from the choir, our director, she came and she just gave us the scores. We read the music, blah, blah, blah. We were working on it. And then she sent us this recording to listen to it. And I was just like, wow. This is absolutely mesmerizing. It's so beautiful that I was like, wow. It really got tears in my eyes. And I was really, I feel like that was one of the first pieces that I really had a very strong emotional connection. And even now when I'm listening to it, I have all of those memories and the taste and the smell of that particular moment when I listened to it for the first time.
Ask you about your breakdancing, because obviously we did a feature on it in the magazine maybe 2 years ago now. Can you tell me a bit about it and how the physical movement helps or hinders your singing in any way?
I still do it very actively. I do not participate in any sort of competitions. I don't do that, and I don't like when people write sometimes in interviews that it's my hobby. It's not my hobby. Breaking is sort of choice for life, and you can stop doing it, but it's still part of you. Like it's a lifestyle, and it's still something that I do really often, because every other day basically I have my crew, Skill Fanatics crew, and I just love it. And I think it's not easy. It's really not easy to do something so extreme like breaking and be a professional singer. But it is possible, and you just have to put a lot of work into analyzing yourself and your body, basically, to be able to sustain your career and to actually be able to get something from one art form and put it into the other. And it really takes time, because I really spent a lot of time in my practice room, just analyzing what is good, what is not good, what kind of like parts of muscles I'm using while I'm singing, what actually I'm doing when I'm dancing. And then really I am very aware what's happening, because you know, for every single muscle you need to use oxygen so that the muscle can work. So if you sing and suddenly you have the whole arm sort of, you know, stiff and flexed, you are using a lot of oxygen that you could use for singing. So it's very useful to actually be aware what actually your body is doing. So, and there are also a lot of exercises from breaking that I'm using always before singing, always, because it's just it's like part of my warm up. Like as soon as my body is awake, my voice is right away much more ready to start, and I can do the work quicker and I think better. But it's just my sort of experience, and I cannot. It's not a golden rule that you have to be a breaker to be a singer, but it helps me. It helps me to have the this kind of also mental stability, because classical world can be cruel. It can. It's beautiful. I love it. I love it. But it can be tough. It can be tough, and it's very, very heavy when you, especially when you produce a lot of things. And I'm a freelancer of that type, that I produce a lot of things for myself. And for the others, of course, but I do produce a lot of stuff, and it's intense. It's very stressful. So that's also my way of meditating and having some sort of different society that I can relate to and just spend time and be out of all of that.
You said that you had a crew that you kind of do it with, but for the last year, is it quite a solitary activity?
Not really. I mean, to be honest, we just, because we have an access here in Warsaw to a studio, so we can use it, because legally we can also, my friends are doing private classes. So, and there are three rooms. So when they are practicing in one room, there are like two people on a huge, you know, sort of gym or dance room. And me and my other friend are in the other room. So it's, of course, it's not like it used to be that we were like 10 or 15 people in one room, which was more like a jam sort of situation, and everybody's jamming and enjoying and practicing. But still, like we meet and we practice together, but with like, of course, smaller groups.
And so what's the music that you play when you're breaking? Is what kind of music?
So usually those are what's called breakbeats or like funk music, but sometimes it's like house music, sometimes like really sort of rap or some sort of hip hop. Like one of my favorite crews is from Australia, Hilltop Hoods. Really amazing stuff, and I really highly recommend, because they recorded an album with the symphony orchestra.
Oh, wow.
And it's
your two worlds collide.
No, it's beautiful. It's just incredibly beautiful. It's awesome. So and I like to change the music, because it has all the different rhythm and different vibe. So so then you come up with totally different ideas for your moves, for your steps. So it's really sort of inspiring. The music has a kind of crucial effect on what you are actually doing.
Do you listen to it just when you're breaking, or do you ever listen to it separate from the activity?
Separately also.
Yeah. Okay, so obviously in the last year, live performances have been slightly stripped back. How have you felt like you've needed to kind of stay match fit with fewer performances to prepare for?
I mean, to be honest, I'm kind of good in finding for myself things. And because I've been producing for myself since the beginning of my career, really. So I didn't really struggle with not having work to do. I constantly had so much work. Plus, one of the most annoying things, like the cancellations, and also dealing with those cancellations in a meaning of like, okay, so let's do it in a month, so let's find the date, let's find boom boom boom, and rescheduling and finding different sort of adapting to the restrictions that are currently occurring in this particular country. was the most difficult job of them all, because this is something that, for example, like in we supposed to have a concert in Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, and it was already postponed three times, and this, like, every single time we were discussing different rules that we can do that concert. So once with the 50% of public, then the streaming, then something else, then different program, because they cannot have a break. And it's like hundreds or even thousands of emails, and nobody's paying you for this. And you are like, yeah. I'm not going to say I'm losing time, but it is sort of lost time in your life, because you're really trying. And I'm really grateful for those institutions that they really try to make something happen. But it's incredibly difficult, not only for them, but for artists like me to answer all of that, because managements cannot manage everything when they have such, you know, such list of artists, and everything is just in, you know, is a little bit, messed up.
So as a touring musician, how many, in usual times, how many live performances or concerts are you able to attend as an audience member?
Difficult question, difficult question. But whenever I have an opera production, for example, like in Zurich or in Karlsruhe, the last production that I did was in Karlsruhe in 2020. So then I really go to performances in that place. Like, I am just rehearsing, so I don't have to really care about like the quality of my sound every single day. Yeah. I have to be in shape and participate in the rehearsal, but I can go and listen to other performances. So yeah, I go quite a lot, but when I'm on tour, it's almost impossible, because usually it's like you perform on Wednesday, then you travel on Thursday, and on Friday you have another concert somewhere else, then on Saturday you travel, then on Sunday you have another concert, and that's how it is. So almost impossible. So it's usually when I'm going for opera productions that I'm actually enjoying and going for everything they have.
Yeah. Can you think of the best concert you've ever been to, either while you've been in an opera or outside of your musical life? Is there any that stands out?
I mean, there were quite a lot of memorable things. Like, for example, there is this famous, I don't remember, and I feel horrible about that. I don't remember the stage director, but there is this famous magic flute, which was also in Festival d'Aix-en-Provence. And that production was just amazing. It was so cleverly done with the sound booth on the right side, when they were really producing like some sort of sound effects, and also with the sort of camera guy inside of other sort of box, and he was drawing and it was appearing on the huge screen on stage. It was really, really amazing, like very entertaining, very well done, because it was a really, really good cast. So also the level of the singers and the orchestra, of course, it's Festival d'Aix-en-Provence, so it's the highest possible level. So that was one of the performances that I was like, wow. But also, I have to say, one of the best concerts in my life was in New York when I was studying in Juilliard. For quite a long time, I am a huge fan of Lucas Graham. But so I listened to him for already like, I don't know how many years. But I was in Juilliard, and then I saw this sort of quick ad somewhere in the internet that like he's performing in New York, and it was before he got like really, really big, like right now, because it was in 2016, I think. Oh, wow. Or 17 or something like that. And I sent a message to my friend like, hey, do you want to go for a concert with me? And like, blah, blah, blah. So I went there, and this concert was just mind blowing. There was so much energy, and I have such a respect for him, because when I like an artist or an actor, whoever, I always not only check the sort of the artistry, but I also check interviews and like some sort of, you know, because I want to know what kind of person that particular artist is, and he's a super cool guy from Copenhagen, which is one of my favorite cities. And also, he comes from the choir background. Like, he was singing as a choir member for quite a long time. Also, so I had this sort of connection, and I felt it, and I thought he's an incredible artist. And this live concert was just stunning.
What was he performing? What was the program? Do you remember?
I remember that it was from his first album, so it was a lot of this sort of old stuff, but it was fire. But
have you seen him any point since then, or is that the only time you've seen him?
Unfortunately not, because I was traveling all the time, and now, you know, the concerts are not really possible, so I'm waiting for the next opportunity.
Sometime. So when you're at home or on the go, what do you listen to and how do you discover new music?
Usually, you know, because I love to discover new music. So there are a lot of sort of playlists made by my friends or playlists done by some other artists, which I follow on, for example, Spotify. Or I just put, for example, a mood that I want to like hear a particular mood of music or genre of music, and I put it in, check one or two playlists, and boom, just put it in. And I'm horrible at remembering names. So like really, really horrible. I cannot remember any titles, like any artists. I'm really sad about that. But fortunately, I have my playlists or some kind of saved playlists on my Spotify. So then I listen to them, and I love it. So like there is a particular playlist which I like to put in the morning because it has a very sort of positive vibey thing, and it's called Kitchen Swagger. So
nice.
So it's super nice. So I cannot even tell you what kind of artists are there, but it's a great playlist.
So on both of your first two albums, both of them feature, am I right in thinking it's about 8 world premieres on each one? Is that right?
On the first one, yes. On the second one, I don't remember.
No.
There are quite a lot, quite a lot of world premieres, yes.
So what's the process involved for you in kind of discovering those arias or those songs and getting them recorded?
It's intense. It takes time, but it's super interesting. I have what I call a treasure hunter. So I have a very good friend, Yanis François, who is a great singer also, bass baritone. And he also comes from a dancer background. And we met in Gießen in Germany for a production. He was the main bad character. I was singing like some sort of secondary role. And we really got kind of like our friendship got really close when I got the offer from Warner Classics to record an album. And I remembered that he was sort of obsessed with castrati and the program of like Baroque music. And then I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, I think I know the guy. So I called him and I said like, hey, I have this offer and I think I want to do this and this and that and that. And can you help me find the music? So the first album, Anima Sacra, we composed the program for like, it took us a year and a half almost.
Wow. Yeah.
So it was a lot of time because he was traveling a lot and finding those pieces in different libraries. And sometimes it's a manuscript, so you have to then edit it into our modern notation. Sometimes it's not even a manuscript because it's not accessible. They send you a photo, like some sort of photo, which
great.
You have to like, or they send you a manuscript, but in a way that like, it's not as a whole score, but it's like you have separately first violin, the separately you have a score for the,
The parts.
Second violin. Yeah, the parts of the for the orchestra, but sometimes like some bars of pauses are missing. So then you have to like really like write it into our modern notation, but then also do the puzzle work, sort of like, hey, this doesn't go together. Like, what's happening? Because somebody 300 years ago forgot to write that there are 10 bars of, you know, of pausa. So yeah, it is a complicated and long process, but it's super exciting because once you find something, and it's super risky, I have to say, because you never know how it's going to sound. So when we do those things, we put it into modern notation. So then you can put the sound on in some kind of programs. Like you have this MIDI sound. So it sounds horrible. Mm. But and then you have to imagine all the whole orchestra playing it. And most of the time I go and play it with my pianist or with my friend who plays on a harpsichord. So then I have sort of an imagination of how this whole thing will happen, like how it will sound. But actually, you are never sure if it's going to be good or not. So then you go, you record with the orchestra. And when you're in the room with them, then there is this moment of like, we will see, it's going to be good or not.
So, have you had any hairy moments where you've gone and put it with an orchestra and it's been like, no, that's not right?
I mean, there was one piece that I was really stressed about because I thought it's genius, but the conductor said like, hey, it's bad. So then I had to sort of convince him and I introduced my ideas how to play it. And then sort of, because he's a very open-minded conductor, he said like, oh my gosh, yes. So let's do also this and this. And then he put his magic and then suddenly we have one of the best tracks of the album. So fortunately it got like to this sort of direction, but the first sort of talk with him and listening to what we have was stressful. Hearing that sort of feedback.
I guess with a project like that, when you have nothing to listen to kind of build your interpretation, maybe that opens, does it open up more for you to...
Of course, it is really difficult sometimes because there is literally nothing that you can relate to. There is literally nothing. So majority of times you are the first one. So you are like the trendsetter, let's say. So it is exciting. It is stressful. It is risky because you never know if the album will kind of be successful. But I like it. I like it. And I talked with Filip Żarówski about that on our sort of first live interaction, that like he also did a lot of those kind of discoveries, like Cecilia Bartoli and like many, many others. And I don't do it, like, I don't force it. It was just my idea of what I want to present on the first album, Anima Sacra. So, like, my kind of artistic statement. And there are a lot of arguments behind every single piece. And because I could afford to collaborate with Yanis, who found all of those pieces and helped me build the whole sort of theme and the album in a way that I wanted it to look like this. I'm lucky that I could do that and take that risk to put on my first solo album as a very young singer so many world premieres. And I'm glad that it turned out well because it was really stressful at the beginning and very, very risky.
By the time you come to the pieces that are better known and have been performed a bunch of times, is that like a moment of relief when you're putting an album together of like that, where you know where you stand?
There are two sides of the medal, as we say here in Poland, because when, for example, I just it will be out. I don't really know when, but I recorded, for example, Stabat Mater by Vivaldi, and it's such a famous piece of music that like. There are certain expectations when you play something like that. So it's on the other hand, like really sort of stressful in a way that like you have to do it well, but also you don't want to do it in a way that everybody is doing it. Fortunately, I think I developed already my style of singing and my style of ornamenting different composers. So I feel quite relaxed and I don't really stress. I'm in general, like, I'm not really stressing about things. I do my thing, and if you like it, then great. If you don't, happens. You cannot please everyone. So I do things my way. Of course, I take constructive criticism, but I do those things like my way. And I have, fortunately, I have a lot of ideas. So even for that Stabat Mater by Vivaldi, I already had so many ideas of how I want to do it in a vocal line, but also from the orchestra side. So, so I'm not stressing about that.
Mm. So with a piece like that, how will you research it? Will you listen extensively to other interpretations while you're in the process of working out yours?
In general, I first work on the piece. I first read it. Yeah. So for example, if I prepare an opera, like now I prepare Tamerlano by Handel, I don't like to listen, because even though you might think you are not relying your interpretation on somebody else's interpretation, it's like it's happening unconsciously. It's just happening. Unconsciously, it is happening. So I prefer to read the music by myself, just in my studio, just me, no pianist, nobody involved. Like, I do it myself, and I take a lot of time because I'm pretty slow, but I love to take my time, because then I'm sure that I prepared the music in a very well, in a very good way, and I know it well. So then I build sort of my interpretation of the character. I read the whole story, the background, and blah blah blah. So I do all of those things, and then I sing it. And majority of times, I right away have my sort of point of view, and then just out of curiosity, I listen to different interpretations, because the tempo is different, the voices are different. Sometimes it's sung by a countertenor, sometimes it's sung by a contralto or mezzo soprano. So it's really interesting also to take and learn something from other interpretations, but not take them and copy them.
Yeah. So is there one piece of music, either something that you would love to sing as a performer, or just one piece that is kind of your desert island disc and you can't live without and will turn to time and time again? Do you have one piece like that?
I mean, when I started studying, if it's like we are talking about the classical world, I started studying, and on my first year, my teacher, Anna Radziejewska, gave me an aria by Rinaldo, from Rinaldo by Handel. And like after like 2 years, 3 years, when I was constantly working on few arias from Rinaldo, I thought like, wow, it would be my dream, like really the biggest dream, to sing that role one day, someday, maybe. And then I had this chance and I sang it in Frankfurt. I think it was 2018. I think so, but it was a big thing for me, because like from the point of view of me being a very bad singer while I was studying here in Warsaw and dreaming those big dreams of like, oh, title role in a Handel opera, and suddenly a few years later you get an offer from a major house actually in Europe and you perform it on stage, it was amazing. And there are so many arias that I really, as a person, I relate to, and I think that's why our productions were also very satisfying, because I really could enter the world fully. And then also this jump in situation in Glyndebourne Festival, which was like one of the funniest and the best productions I've ever done, because exactly of this comic sort of comedy aspect. So I did it already like 4 times, this whole opera, and this is still like, I think it's an opera that I will do for many, many more years, because I think it got me, and I think I can do it well.
Is there one aria in that in particular, or a couple, that you always really look forward to on a performance?
I mean, there is a lot of pressure put on Cara Sposa, of course, but I love to sing it. I mean, this aria is just when it's played well, and the sort of the set and everything is like it should be, sort of. So like we had in Frankfurt, it was totally different in Frankfurt and in Glyndebourne, but both settings were amazing. It was so so fun to sing it. It's really emotionally very, very heavy, but I really like it. The whole sort of build-up of this character is amazing. So that's why, like, it's very fun to perform the whole character, like, one aria by one, because on every aria you have something different to sell, and it's fun, because at the end you have Orla Tromba, and in this Glyndebourne production, I was waiting for the whole show until this Orla Tromba, because we had a lot of improvising. So there was the whole group behind me, sort of like miming what I am doing. So that was their challenge. Like, I had to, and you know, usually people do sort of choreographies, so for every show is sort of the same, but I like to take risks. So I, for every single performance, I was doing something different. So they really had to look at me and do exactly what I was doing. So it was super, super fun.
That was Jakub Józef Orliński talking to me from his flat in Warsaw. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast from the team at BBC Music Magazine. Do let us know what you think of the podcast by rating and reviewing it wherever you've been listening. If you want to find out more about BBC Music Magazine, we're available in print and various digital formats across the world. Or you can visit our website, classical-music.com, where you can read about all the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews, and a good deal more. Thanks to Acast for hosting and Brittany Colley for production.